Chapter 13. Computer Crime. Modern life is dominated by computers. Wages are calculated, cars built, planes flown, and children taught by them. Yet very few people know anything about how they work or how they came to be invented. A computer is made up of a processing unit and a memory. The processing unit combines numbers to form other numbers using basic operations such as addition and subtraction. The memory stores a list of the numbers to go into the processor, and the results then come out of the processor. A man, an abacus, and a long sheet of paper could fulfil the same function. Where computers score over their human counterpart is their immense speed. Modern personal computers have their speed measured in MIPS, or millions of instructions per second. Although the human brain can't compete with a computer in terms of speed, computers have nothing comparable to human intelligence or judgment. The only way in which computers can mimic intelligence is by using conditions. A human can tell the computer to look at the results of one of its sums and to choose what to do next on the basis of what it finds. In effect, a computer can think if you tell it what to think. Setting up the sets of rigid choices for the computer to follow is known as programming. Once you have a machine that can do arithmetic and make conditional decisions, you have a modern computer. In the 17th century, technologists such as Blaise Pascal and Gottfried Wilhelm von Leibniz built mechanical versions of the processing part of the modern computer. These were referred to as mechanical calculators. They could do arithmetic accurately, but they lacked the ability to examine their own conclusions and to act accordingly. In the 19th century, the British scientist Charles Babbage, working under government sponsorship, built the first machine capable of these conditional instructions. His analytical engine was the forerunner of the modern computer. The rigid logic of computers leads to both their accuracy and to their potential for misuse. Human intelligence allows us to evaluate the instructions given to us by others using information from many sources. Are the instructions wise? Do we trust the person giving them to us? Computers can only test what we ask them to test, and for that reason they're wide open to misuses not foreseen by the computer's programmer. Viruses are an example of this kind of misuse. During the 1970s and the 1980s, one of the favourite arguments among computer buffs was the question, can life be simulated on a computer? Obviously, a human being or a dog would be far too complicated to simulate, but scientists suspected that a single-celled organism, with no real intelligence and a few drives, could perhaps be made successfully. A simple model called life was programmed, based on a grid filled with little computer creatures. Every second, the computer would check each creature on the grid. If it were not next to any of its fellow creatures, it would die or disappear. If it were completely surrounded by fellow creatures, it would also die. But if it was only half surrounded, it would breed and fill one of the adjacent empty squares with a new creature. Watching the grid change from second to second, the scientists were amazed to see what looked like bacteria growing on a petri dish. The computer simulation, although very primitive, seemed to be on the right track. In the same spirit of imitating life, a program was worked out that could breed, make copies of itself in a computer's memory, and move, transfer itself to other computers. And this kind of program is known as a computer virus. The original viruses worked by attaching themselves to the list of instructions that come up on the screen when the computer is turned on. This list is known as the boot sector. The virus would then come to life when the computer started and remain alive until it was turned off. Of course, it would be back the next time the computer was used. While it was alive, the virus would monitor the floppy disk drive, waiting for a new disk to be inserted. When it was, the virus would attach itself to the floppy disk's boot sector. If the disk were then moved to another computer, the virus would spread to it and thus multiply. As soon as it was established that such programs were possible, everyone began writing them. The original viruses were non-damaging, but had the potential to spread without being noticed. Most of the new viruses were written by bored hackers with the express intention of destroying information on people's computers. To extend the simulated life metaphor, these viruses moved, bred, and also ate unprotected data. The writing of viruses is now a crime. In 1995, Christopher Pyle of Plymouth in Devon was jailed for 18 months for writing a virus that deliberately destroyed data on selected computers between 4 and 5 o'clock on Wednesday afternoons. One software company estimated that the virus had cost them £500,000 in lost data. Writing viruses amounts to electronic vandalism. Because computers have become so central to the administration of everything, from airlines to hospitals, computer vandalism could cost lives. Computers can also be used to commit serious crimes. Banks use networks of machines to administer their cash transfers, providing instant movement of cash for the demands of today's global markets. The banks would have us believe that their security is perfect and that our money is safe, stored as digits in their computer's memory. Yet, as we've seen, all computers are vulnerable to unauthorized instructions, and any system is only as secure as it has been programmed to be. As in the following case, if a criminal gains unauthorized access to the network, bank robbery can be as simple as pressing a button. One morning, late in 1994, traders in the Buenos Aires office of Invest Capital, a multinational stockbroking business, turned on their computers to find that $200,000 of their money had disappeared. It had definitely been there the previous night, sitting in their cash account, waiting to honour the previous day's buying commitments. Without the cash, the stockbrokers would have to break these commitments, a tremendously damaging prospect. Frantic with worry, the office chief rang the firm's bankers, Citibank. He was told that the money would be refunded immediately. The bank would handle the investigation and would also find the error that had caused the loss. Reassured, Invest Capital's office chief rang off and started the day's trading. One thing puzzled him, however. Why was Citibank so calm about the loss of $200,000? Well, the answer was that Citibank had already lost sums to computer criminals that made $200,000 seem like a drop in the ocean. From its headquarters at 111 Wall Street, New York, Citibank oversees the movement of a truly staggering amount of money, over $5 trillion every day. Using its computer-based cash management system, vast sums can be moved around the stock markets of the world, surfing the waves of global capitalism. With sums like that appearing and disappearing all over the world, directed only by a flow of electronic pulses down a phone line, it was inevitable that certain people who knew all about computers were going to try to interfere. Such people are now known as hackers. Hackers test the security of other people's computer systems and try to gain access to them by guessing or stealing passwords or finding mistakes in the programs that control security. Once they're inside someone else's computer, most hackers stop there. The challenge of breaking in is what motivates them, and most don't want to commit serious fraud. They just want to prove that they're cleverer than the experts who try to keep them out. However, not all hackers shy away from serious crime. On June 1, 1994, Citibank suffered the first of a series of hacking attacks to their computer cash management system. The Philippines National Bank in Hong Kong lost $500,000 from its Citibank account. The money was transferred without permission to an account in Finland. By the time that Citibank security had pinned down the transfer, the money had been withdrawn. If this money had been stolen in a bank robbery or a security van hold-up, Citibank would have gone to the police immediately. But this situation was different. It needed careful handling. If all of Citibank's big corporate customers knew that their cash management system could not be trusted, the bank would be in dire trouble. The resulting bad publicity could destroy Citibank's image forever. Therefore, they quietly refunded the missing $500,000 and set about the task of closing their security loophole. A task force was appointed within the bank, and their first job was to question the staff who administered the cash management system. This kind of robbery almost always hinges on the help of an insider supplying passwords or deliberately lowering security screens. Yet, despite extensive investigations, the task force could find no suspects within its own staff. It seemed that the bleakest explanation was the right one. The bank's computers had been hacked into from outside over the international phone lines. Tracing the criminals would be next to impossible, and the hackers, knowing this, were very likely to strike again. All the bank's task force could do was to monitor each transaction, looking for anomalies and hoping that the hackers would slip up. Over the next 3 months, Citibank was hit another 16 times. By the end of August, they'd lost over $3,500,000. The pattern was always the same. A big customer who made many large transfers would suddenly discover that hundreds of thousands of dollars had been transferred without authorization to an obscure bank in Europe or the Middle East. Because the customers were making large transfers simultaneously, the loss could often go undetected for days. Often, by the time they were discovered, a bagman or mule would have withdrawn the money from the destination bank and disappeared. Clearly, Citibank was being targeted by a highly organized international gang, whose secret robberies were slowly strangling its business. The task force's job was daunting. They first had to find one illegal transaction in a surge of legitimate cash flow. Then, once they'd found it, they had to act fast enough to stop the money from being withdrawn and lost forever. It seemed an impossible task until the morning of the Invest Capital theft in Buenos Aires. It also explains why Citibank sounded so unconcerned. This was the opportunity that they had been waiting for. As soon as Invest Capital's office contacted them, the task force swung into action. The illegal transaction had occurred the previous night. There was still time to stop the money before it was withdrawn by a bagman. Invest Capital's $200,000 had been sent in four different directions, three of them abroad. There was almost no chance of catching these in time. However, one of the amounts had gone to a branch of the Wells Fargo Bank in San Francisco. A phone call confirmed that the cash was still there, in an account in the name of Korolkov. Citibank called the police and put them on alert. If anyone tried to touch the San Francisco money, the police would be waiting. 4 days later, a Russian lady named Korolkov walked into the bank and tried to withdraw Invest Capital's money. She was arrested and taken in for questioning by the San Francisco police. Mrs. Korolkov was a Russian immigrant, originally from St. Petersburg. Unfortunately for Citibank, she seemed to know nothing about the transfers. Her husband, Yevgeny Korolkov, had told her to withdraw the money from their account. Yevgeny himself had fled the country before the police could arrest him. Frustrated, the Citibank task force sat back and waited for another chance. Clearly, the hackers were well organized and on their guard. After the arrest of Mrs. Korolkov, the illegal transfers continued, avoiding banks in the US. It looked as though the hackers had learned their lesson. Yet, just as things looked hopeless, the bank's investigators had another stroke of luck. A rogue transfer to a bank in Rotterdam, Holland, was detected almost immediately. Acting fast, the task force rang the Dutch police and told them to arrest anyone who tried to withdraw the money. Shortly after, a man named Vladimir Voronin entered the bank, wrote a cheque, accepted a cup of coffee from the bank's staff, and was arrested by the Dutch police. Voronin, like Mrs. Korolkov, was a Russian from St. Petersburg. Neither of the two suspects appeared to be hardened criminals. Indeed, Voronin was eager to reveal his part in the transactions. He had, he explained, got into debt with the Russian mafia. This huge criminal brotherhood, which had grown up since the collapse of communism in the former Soviet Union, controlled huge drugs and prostitution empires in the former Soviet states. The mafia had suggested to Voronin that rather than pay them back their money, he could do them a little favour. They had contacts in US banking, they explained, who could get them all the money they wanted. What they really needed was a supply of people to act as cash couriers. These people would open accounts in foreign countries, which would then be credited with large sums of money. The innocent account holder would then withdraw the cash, give it to the mafia, and receive their fee. It was an offer Voronin would have been unwise to refuse. What Voronin could not or would not give the police was the name of his mafia contact. Even if he could have, it didn't answer Citibank's most pressing problem: how was the money being diverted? Faced with another dead end in their investigations, the task force directed their efforts towards tracing the calls that had arranged the transactions. By using modern digital telephone exchanges, hackers can choose to send their telephone call through a series of points all over the globe before finally connecting with the computer they're breaking into. The digital exchanges also digitally log the calls they carry. In this way, a trace was theoretically possible, although in practice it would require the cooperation of many different phone companies worldwide. A brief investigation confirmed the task force's worst fears. The hackers had routed their call through telephone exchange after telephone exchange, zigzagging the Earth's surface. Nevertheless, with no option available to them now, the task force had no choice but to trace one of the earlier attacks. After painstakingly examining the records of 11 different telecom providers, the trail led right to where they had expected, St. Petersburg. Yet, just when they were beginning to think they had caught up with the hackers, the trail went cold. The telephone exchange in St. Petersburg, through which the hackers had dialed, was one of the few mechanical exchanges left in the world. Instead of computers assigning and managing lines, the St. Petersburg exchange had magnetic switches clacking back and forth all day. Ironically, the high-tech hackers' last line of defence was the lowest kind of telephone technology. The only way to trace a call through a mechanical exchange was to find the correct relay, one out of hundreds, while the caller was still connected. Then the tracer would have to quickly note down which switches were connected, and from that discover the hacker's phone number. After weeks of waiting and false alarms, the task force were rewarded with success. The hacker dialed into the exchange to initiate an attack. He stayed on the phone just long enough for the St. Petersburg phone officials to trace the origin of the call, the offices of a computer software firm called AO Saturn, based in a decaying but grand office building in a rundown area of the city. At last, it seemed that the investigators were getting somewhere. Nevertheless, they didn't want to raid the office and indiscriminately arrest everyone. They needed to know which member of AO Saturn's staff was the hacker. The police quietly recruited some office cleaners to watch the computer employees. They also set up an observation post in a building opposite, and then they waited. Unfortunately, almost everyone in the office seemed to use the computer in question, as it was the only one with a modem. The cleaners could only tell the police about who worked at the computer and when, not what they were doing. Maddeningly, it seemed that they had another dead end. Back in the US, the FBI was busy building a case against the first mule, Mrs. Korolkov. In the tradition of American judicial horse trading, the FBI contacted Yevgeny Korolkov and offered him a deal. If he agreed to identify the hacker in AO Saturn, they would reduce or even drop the charges against his wife. Reluctantly, Korolkov agreed. According to Korolkov, the hacker was a young payroll programmer named Vladimir Levin. Korolkov himself had once been a driver for the software firm and claimed to have seen Levin accessing Citibank's cash management system and monitoring big transactions for places in which to hide his illegal transfers. The FBI was not completely convinced by Korolkov's claims. They insisted that he make a monitored phone call to Levin, during which he would try to get the hacker to admit to his crimes. The equipment was set up, Korolkov coached, and the call made. On the other end of the line, Levin was letting nothing slip. He acknowledged that he knew Korolkov, and that was about all. The phone was bugged, he said, and he didn't want to talk. Korolkov rang off without the confession he was hoping for. Despite this failure, the FBI decided to go ahead with proceedings against Levin. After all, what else did they have? With the FBI publicly out to arrest him, one might have expected Vladimir Levin to have gone into hiding, or at least to have stayed in Russia, which has no treaty of extradition with the US. Puzzlingly, however, in March 1995, Levin decided to fly to London to attend a computer exhibition. The Russian police rang their British counterparts, and the moment Levin's plane touched down at Stansted Airport, he was arrested and taken to Brixton Prison. He was wanted in the US for bank theft and wire fraud, for which he could be jailed for up to 65 years. In his cell in Brixton, Levin didn't look like the usual picture of a bank robber. His pale, boyish looks made him seem much younger than his 30 years. He wore thick glasses and had gangling limbs. In fact, he looked like the archetypal computer nerd. From the beginning, Levin denied the FBI's charges and set about with his British lawyer, Alan Jones, fighting extradition to the US. An American public defender was also appointed for Levin, but Levin rejected him, convinced that he was an FBI agent. The FBI would probably have benefited greatly from a mole inside Levin's defence. Their case was shaky as it was built on the evidence of only one man, Korolkov. They had only 60 days in which to prove that Levin had a case to answer. They appealed to the St. Petersburg police for help, who were happy to oblige. Levin lived with his parents, who soon found the police kicking in their front door. General Sidorenko of the RUOP, that's the St. Petersburg Anti-Organised Crime Squad, reported that swoops on Levin's apartment and those of other suspects netted floppy disks full of incriminating information, as well as many illegal firearms, seemingly confirming the Russian mafia link. Other members of Levin's gang, including the head of AO Saturn, were also arrested, as was a man named Lashmanov, who claimed to be Levin's deputy. The FBI had the evidence they needed for an extradition application, and it seemed unlikely that the British judiciary would turn it down. In late 1995, they upheld the US request, and Levin appealed. Meanwhile, back in St. Petersburg, Lashmanov had been tried for his part in Citibank transfers to accounts in Tel Aviv. He pleaded guilty for a maximum sentence of 5 years. In Brixton, Levin insisted to anyone who would listen that he had never even met Lashmanov. Four other members of the gang arrested in St. Petersburg made plea bargains with the US authorities. By September 1997, Levin had exhausted all means of appeal in Britain and was extradited to the US. With Levin's extradition, the FBI seemed happy to accept that they had apprehended all the criminals responsible for the Citibank fraud. But there were doubts. In 1996, Channel 4 TV in the UK made a documentary about the Citibank wire fraud case. They succeeded in tracking down a Russian hacker living in a squat in St. Petersburg. In the computer underground, he was known by the nickname Megazoid. Megazoid, an unemployed university graduate, told the makers of the documentary that it was he, and not Levin, who had broken into Citibank's cash management security. Megazoid was of the old school of hackers, rigidly adhering to the libertarian code of breaking and entering computer systems without stealing or damaging data. His tools were a computer that cost him $10 and a modem that he got in exchange for a bottle of vodka. According to Megazoid, he and his fellow hackers had originally gained access to Citibank not through cunning, but through luck. Hackers often engage in a process known as war dialing. This means ringing every phone number in an area and searching for a response from another computer. There's no skill involved, it just takes time. Once a computer is located, then the hacker's skills can be brought to break open the computer's security, except that in the case of Citibank, there was no security. Megazoid claims to have stumbled upon an open modem, meaning that there was no password or security check required to use it. What's more, the computer to which the modem connected was that of a system administrator at Citibank. Without cracking a single code, Megazoid claims, he had control over all the bank's security arrangements. For 3 months in 1993, Megazoid was using the Citibank administrator's computer to thoroughly compromise Citibank's security. He built so-called backdoors into all password programs, allowing easy access to those in the know. Finally, Megazoid got bored with playing with Citibank's security. He contacted the system administrator, offering to cooperate in repairing the many faulty security procedures in the cash management system, not all of which were created by him. Apparently, the administrator agreed. The two cooperated until the administrator was convinced that the system was safe. Then he tried to lock Megazoid out. That was a mistake, as any decent hacker was naturally going to leave himself a way of getting back in, even if he'd helped to bar the door against his colleagues. Megazoid simply broke back in. Naturally, Megazoid's hacker friends knew of his successes. Half the fun of hacking was boasting about it afterwards. Shortly after Megazoid let himself back into Citibank, one of his fellow hackers got drunk in a bar with a member of the Russian mafia. In exchange for $100 and two bottles of vodka, Megazoid's friend exposed the secret Citibank vulnerability. With the growing popularity of the internet, a worldwide network of computers, computer hacking is bound to increase. Banks are beginning to offer customers the kind of services that Citibank's closed cash management system offered large companies in the mid-90s, using the internet as a means of connecting the customer's home PC to the bank's central computer. Both the US government and the global banking network want more business transferred to the internet. It would allow the banks to cut staffing levels. With a combination of automatic telling machines and home banking, the customer would never need to visit a branch again. Many governments are already planning new taxes on data travelling between computers and on sales made using computers. The taxes would be automatically debited from the computer's bank account, cutting out any collection problems. The last thing that any of these groups wants publicised is the fact that no computer network can ever be 100% secure. The Citibank thefts are not the only ones of their kind. Computer security experts all agree that banks lose millions every year to computer fraud. Banks are only interested in publicising fraud where they can point to a successful conclusion. In the Levin case, Citibank can claim that the problems in their systems have been found and removed. The FBI can claim to have an effective policy on computer crime. Yet, as we've seen, there are intriguing hints that Vladimir Levin and his hacker friends were not the only criminals in this case. Given the opportunity to allow Levin to take part in an investigation of his possible paymasters, the Russian mafia, the FBI refused to let him go. Despite some initial loss of custom after the case, Citibank have recovered the confidence of the business community. They've won the publicity battle. In a world where hackers gain skill at the same rate as the security experts, and the threat of computer fraud can never be completely eradicated, that is the most important thing.